Okay, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this further seminar in our series with the Hellenic Observatory. It is a great pleasure to welcome Panayotis Zafonas, professor at the University of Athens, National Kapodistrian University. To some of you, he will be very well known as a leading international relations professor and authority on Greek foreign policy over many years. I'm delighted that we have some diversity in the audience, so that requires me to introduce him a little bit more. Panayotis is also director of the MA program in International and European Government and Policy, director of the Institute of Migration and Diaspora Studies, head of the program on foreign policy and security at LUM. And he's held research posts in Harvard, Yale, and Oxford. He's published extensively books, monographs, contributions, articles in leading journals in Greek, English, German, French, and Italian. He's also served as scientific advisor at the Ministry of National Defense, a special advisor to the Minister of Foreign Affairs, and as president of the Board of Directors for the Center for Security Studies. More recently, he's co-authored with Thanos Dokos two books on national security strategy. His book, The Incomplete Breakthrough in Greek-Turkish Relations, Grasping Greece's Socialization Strategy, was nominated by the Modern Greek Studies Association for the prestigious Edmund Healy Book Prize. So we're delighted to welcome you, Panayotis. The title, as you can see behind me, is Greece's Strategy vis-à-vis Turkey, From Hard to Smart Balancing. Very timely, very topical, and we have a leading authority to guide us through. So welcome, over to you.
Thank you very much, Kevin. You can all hear me. Today's presentation is a kind of a follow-up on what I have already produced about 10 years ago on Greece's socialization strategy as a means of better dealing with what has been considered as the main security threat for Greece over the course of half of a century. At the time, and I was obliged to Kevin, who has written a blurb on this book, I was attempted to answer two particular questions related to the change that has taken place in Greece's foreign policy, the U-turn, actually, in Greece's foreign policy vis-à-vis Turkey back in the late 90s. So the first question has to do with the why thing, why that major change has taken place. And the explanation, my explanation, after the empirical work was mainly a cultural one, which has to do with the culture of the agents of the time to follow a reformist agenda and resolution agenda. There was also, and that's probably the most interesting part, the how thing, how this happened. And the answer to this question was through the employment of the international socialization theory on international socialization for looking at how a particular state, that is Greece, has attempted to transform the behavior of another state. So what we have known since then was the so-called institutional socialization, the attempt made by NATO, by the European Union, to socialize the states of Central and Eastern Europe. And they did it carefully and successfully to some extent. So the question at the time, I mean, the third question at the time was, can a state employee socialization. And the answer to this question was yes, you can do it successfully. So it might lead to a breakthrough in relations between the threatened and the threatening towards the resolution of the conflict. Since then, there's a funny thing actually about that book, and I have to mention. It was the, I assume, Kevin, you met him, the late Nico Semelis.
Yes.
Was a person of extraordinary quality, and he was very helpful as the leader, as the head of the Prime Minister's office, strategic party.
Under Kostas Tsimitzis.
To provide me with some stuff about the rationale of that change in strategy. So when the book published, I met with Nikos, and after 2 days, he called me and said, "Well, Panagiotis, there are 2 good things about the book, about this book. The first thing is that we did have a strategy," which means that they got an idea about the direction where they should head on, right? But that's one thing, and quite another to come up with a coherent strategy of how exactly we should do it. And the second thing is, he said, that strategy has a name. It is called socialization strategy. So it's a good thing that I got involved in this business, let's say, of British foreign policy at the time, and come up with this kind of conclusions. Then I had to, that was a year ago, I wrote a book, and that's the about the genesis of this lecture today. I wrote a book with the current National Security Advisor of Greece, Thanos Dokos, about a roadmap of Greece's grand strategy, a roadmap of Greece's national security strategy. And at the time, I found out that Greece's balancing strategy vis-à-vis Turkey is only part, by all means, this is an essential part, but only part of Greece's grand strategy. So to the extent, and this is how we move on, to the extent we Greeks, or Greece, we live in a geographically, we geographically located on the verge of a relative world, let's say, of stability, that is Europe, and another of a chaotic world of total instability, that is the Middle East and Africa region. We are obliged somehow to deal with a plethora of new threats and challenges. Not Turkey, or solely Turkey, but many others related to non-traditional issues such as Islamist radicalization, international terrorism, irregular migration, etc. It seems that what many analysts call the poly crisis has become the new norm in the area where we now live, in the Eastern Mediterranean. So how can we really deal with so many threats and challenges, Turkey being only one of them, with, especially after the pandemic, after the Rwanda, and so on and so forth, manage to achieve more with less. That is, we are obliged to punch, as we say, above our weight. And given that Turkey's, or Greece's balancing strategy, Turkey is only part of that bigger picture of Greece's grand strategy. The next question, and this is about speak tonight, is how we can refine the existing balancing strategy so as to become less costly and more efficient at the same time. This is a table with a theoretical model of the Mediterranean security environment being produced by certain analysts in the beginning of the post-Cold War era. You can see here two different levels of analysis, the interstate level and the state level, and various threats challenges emanating on both levels, with some of them being connected. Think of this particular table 30 years later, with many more much more interconnectedness, and many more connections, and some new threats and challenges which do not appear at this table. There are some analysts who have attempted to somehow map or depict what is going on in this particular region, this so-called Middle East and North Africa region, in terms of the relationships being advanced between foes and friends. And they got this, amazingly. So there's a funny thing about that. There is a note saying that Palestine and Israel were discounted for the sake of simplicity. but you got the point.
Could you just go back one second, Chair? I also like that it was derived from the Institute of International Diagrams
That's right. A good point. Okay, so I'll go straight to my presentation regarding my research question. The research question is, as I mentioned, how Greece can advance, can devise a balancing strategy that can be less costly and more efficient at the same time. So that's an introduction of how Greek governments, successive Greek governments, have managed so far to deal with Turkey by employing the two known, common, I would say, ways of dealing with external threats, that is, internal balancing, external balancing, with combination of those two policies being present. Obviously, internal balancing refers to the strengthening of the armed forces. External balancing has to do with, let's say, help from abroad, strengthening from abroad. That is, it depends, of course, how we view abroad and how we can deal with various contributions that might come from abroad. Usually participation in international institutions is the answer to that quest for external balancing. For Greece, European Union and NATO, to a certain extent, were viewed as security providing hegemons for most of the time. European Union and NATO was there for helping somehow Greece to deal with external threats, either as levers of pressure to deter Turkey from potential dangers in the Aegean, or as precious instruments of a strategy of conditional sanctions, which has been the strategy for Greece for many, many years up to the late 90s, and turned to what we call strategy of conditional rewards. That's kind of a review of how successive Greek governments up to the late 90s have managed to deal or have attempted to deal with the external threat based on those two elements of internal balancing and external balancing. As you can see on the third row, military deterrence, that is internal balancing, is there all the time. It never disappears. So strengthening of the armed forces for sending deterrent messages abroad is an obvious, I would say, choice for all governments. What changes, however, is that mixture of the various ingredients, I would say, of external policy. That changes. That's different from time to time. So from the Karamanlis era, Constantine Karamanlis era, the very first year, 5 years of so-called metapolitευση, Karamanlis was interested in strengthening Greece's international standing through participation in major international institutions, with the aim, and that's very important when one refers to Greek-Turkish relations, and this will be highlighted in a few minutes regarding Greece's balancing strategy. What is important is the end state of a strategy. So far, there have been strategies being developed with different end states. One end state might look like normalization of relations, and that's it. And you can achieve normalization of relations by strengthening armed forces, by sending deterrent messages, and that's the end of the story. Balance of power. That's the end of the story. But there have been some other governments who actually driven by different cultures, I would say, a resolution culture, that were interested in not ceasing their attempt to deal, to better deal with Turkey or normalization of relations or balance of power, but they move on to do their best for resolving the conflict with Turkey. So what you see here is different attempts made by in terms of external policy, made by different governments, ending to a different end state, let's say. Constantine Karamanlis was very much interested in resolving the conflict with Turkey. So he was the initiator and a firm supporter of bilateral dialogue, aiming at the resolution of the conflict. Andreas Papandreou was quite a different statesman, interested in containing Turkey and following a policy in terms of external balancing that was much more interested in weakening Turkey's position rather than strengthening Greece's position. So, two different views of how to deal with the external threat. Obviously, that has ended up with a no-dialogue policy, which has been followed by Andreas Papandreou for most part of the 80s, as you know, and which end up with a crisis. This is usually the case. This is how no dialogue policies end. A crisis in April 1987, which led to a kind of neologist on the part of Andreas Papandreou, no war policy. We agree that we disagree, the Davos spirit. Yes, dialogue with Turkey, understanding conditions, but dialogue with Turkey. And then was the end of the Cold War, and Konstantin Mitsotakis' government. Mitsotakis was also a sincere supporter of dialogue with Turkey, with the aim of, with the goal of ending up with the resolution of the conflict. So, in terms of goals, let's say, he was obviously interested in the short term, in the management of the conflict, but in the long run, he was interested in the resolution of the conflict by having a strong belief on the role of international institutions, a very strong belief on the role of international institutions. He thought, for example, that Greece's participation in the Western European Union is a reason enough to change, to somehow talk about Greece's borders becoming European borders, which obviously was not the case. So Mitsotakis' period has, there are so many parents and sons around, was very much interested in having an active dialogue with Turkey, leading to the resolution of the conflict. Yet, that was a government, as you probably know, it was there for 2 years, what about that? It was replaced by the government of Andreas Papandreou, who again thought that the right balancing strategy vis-à-vis Turkey is containment, that is hard balancing, right? That would lead at best to a conditional dialogue with Turkey. Then we had probably the most serious crisis in Greek Turkish relations, the Crimea crisis, in January 1996, and a new government. That new government has experienced the crisis within a week, right, being in government. The management of the crisis obviously was not the best one, yet it was the beginning of a change, a serious change in strategy, in Greece's strategy, in Turkey, by incorporating the U factor within that relations with Turkey. And so we had that breakthrough in Greek Turkish relations based on that policy followed at the time by Greece, which has by all means changed the mixture of external balancing by introducing what is called soft balancing, that is the role international institutions can play for contributing to both better dealing with an enemy, better dealing with a threat, that is somehow borrow the normative power of the international institution that gradually helps the threatened state to better deal with the threat by doing what we call backpassing, passing some of the back of that balancing to the international institution. Of course, with the acceptance of the threatening state, right? Which is not the case right now. Yet, what has happened then, back in the late 90s, particularly in conclusions, the EU conclusions at the EU summit in Helsinki, was exactly that I would have called it a kind of triangle that has managed for the first time to connect three issues which have not been connected so far. That is progress on Turkish candidacy with the resolution of its border conflict with an EU member, that is Greece, with Cyprus becoming a member of European Union without its political problem being resolved, or without its political problem being a prerequisite for its accession. That was amazing. That was really a very good thing for Greece's foreign policy at the time, because you cannot have one without the other. So that was a smart policy followed by Greece, which at the end of a road has led to, that's also a very important thing, to the resolution, to the preparations of the conditions for a resolution of the Greek-Turkish conflict. There was an end on that road. There was a particular time frame, 5 years since the Helsinki decisions, for Greece and Turkey to resolve their differences. How? Well, we have an answer for that through the jurisdiction of the International Court of Justice. We are very much in favor of international law. Okay, what is the best we can get from an international institution, so we are members, towards an aspiring member, is to set the rules. So the European Union has moved on to what I call a revolutionary thing at the time. It has managed to act, and that's the last point, not simply as a framework, you know, that blah, blah, blah thing about Europeanization, sorry, but becoming an active player in the conflict. That is, I try to summarize those things here. Having the EU acting as a framework through various channels, having the EU acting as an active player, meaning resolution of the conflict with Greece has become a community principle, meaning a prerequisite for Turkey's future accession. Number two, Cyprus accession becomes possible regardless of resolution of its long-standing political problem. Of course, there have been some other, I would say, additions to that strategy, to that multilateral strategy of Greece at the time, which had to do with the bilateral level, meaning that there have been certain attempts taken by Greece for creating an institutional safety net, because bilateral relations were still there. They were not, of course, no, they were not worsening, but they were not, you know, as stable as one should probably wish. So at the end of that strategy, that's the most important thing, there was an active dialogue that should be taken and followed by both Greece and Turkey. We call them exploratory talks. And that's the most important thing that led to the change in strategy in the years to come. Greece was committed to a compromise solution by the International Court of Justice in The Hague, meaning that the government at the time was, or at least declared so, willing to accept the compromise course a final agreement with Turkey would entail. That has certain positive effects regarding Turkey. You can see them here at the domestic level, at the elite level, at the societal level, which meant that there has been a change in the process, style, and content of Turkish foreign policy. It has somehow rationalized Turkish foreign policy. Try not to think of today's Turkey. There is nothing to do with Turkey at the time. Okay. And there was a change in strategy with the government, which was not very much in favor of a compromise solution. So it attempted in 2004 to accept, to hold, let's say, the part of that strategy that has no certain costs carried with, meaning that it is a good thing, by all means, that there is a Turkish candidacy. Turkey should move on. European Union will do its part and Europeanize somehow Turkey. So there was not really a need for Greece to pay the bill for a compromise solution. The best thing to do is to emancipate ourselves from the commitments of any EU active role. What this role would entail? Costs. We were not, at the time, ready to pay the cost of a compromise solution, so we thought it is a good thing to let things go along the way they should in terms of having the EU acting as a framework and, by all means, emancipate ourselves from the commitments any EU active role would entail. So we've been to Brussels in 2004, and we thought we should, along with France and Germany, and one should mention that, Merkel and Sarkozy at the time, who had kind of similar thoughts about Turkey, that it would be a good thing for the Helsinki timetable to be withdrawn. No need for Greece and Turkey to solve their problems in 2004. Turkey can only be asked to commit to good neighborly relations. Jurisdiction of the International Court of Justice is not anymore an obligation. It is, if necessary, it is part of that equation. And most importantly, progress on Turkey's membership would no longer be linked to the resolution of the dispute with Greece. That led to what I call conditional dialogue. Instead of sincere dialogue that would lead to the resolution of the conflict, meaning that there had been exploratory talks, by all means, yes, they were there. There's been a continuation of the exploratory talks, but Greece was not anymore committed to a compromise solution. Okay? And that was not without negative consequences. Regarding Turkey, regarding, first of all, Turkey's EU's ability to act as an active player, obviously. But it seems that there have been certain negative consequences with regard to EU's ability to be viewed as a framework with potential positive effects in the long run. This EU's ability was also affected with regard to certain negative trends being developed in various levels. That is, the EU-Turkey relationship within Turkey, with regard to Turkey's foreign policy. Simply put it, less EU, more Middle East-oriented Turkey. That's a list of constraints and incentives or prospects in terms of Turkey's relations after 2004. You see, the list of the constraints is much longer, obviously. Why? The most important thing, in my view, is that rebilateralization of relations between Greece and Turkey. And this is exactly where we now stand. We stand for many years in a rebilateralization of relations, with the prospects of a resolution being solved for good. There has been also a freezing of Turkey's accession process negotiations. Although it started, they were frozen in 2006. And that led to a discussion about a special privileged relationship or partnership between the European Union and Turkey. Then you had the memoranda. Greece's economic crisis has obviously detrimental effects on its international credibility. To many people, when I refer to that, they say, okay, doesn't matter. That's not a big deal. Credibility. Well, as well as on its ability to take initiatives, which is also a very important thing for a state in the international system. For taking initiatives, it should also carry certain amount of credibility. And for Turkey, that was the beginning of that adoption of the outward-looking dynamic foreign policy in Turkey, although it has experienced some defeats. You probably remember Davutoglu referring to zero problems with neighbors that led to zero neighbors. What is important is that the prospects list, which is really poor, obviously. And it is limited to economic cooperation and to attempts for trust building between the two. And also for in terms of high politics issues, the continuation of the so-called exploratory talks, which have started, as I mentioned, already since 2002, right? They kept going, but many but. There were, as you probably know, they ceased sometime in 2016. They were revitalized in January 2021, and they ceased again after three meetings in 2022. There are no exploratory talks as we speak. And that's how things get worse for Turkey. Obviously, you're aware of most of them. I'm going to fast forward on that with Turkey, especially after 2016, after in the post-coup era, and then in 2018, in post-referendum era, moving on to sliding further down. Turkey has turned from one-man party to one-man regime. A very good example of what is called a liberal democracy, with Erdogan being less predictable, less reliable, with less legitimacy, both internally and externally, with much less counterweights within Turkey as well as outside Turkey, with the EU not being a strategic priority by all means, and with the refugee crisis being viewed by Turkey as a leverage for achieving foreign policy goals. Quite a distance from what I have described. And of course, issues related to Greek-Turkish relations that have to do with the geographical broadening of the conflict. It's not in the Aegean anymore. It has been moved off onto the Eastern Mediterranean. The new feature in the bilateral agenda, which has to do with the delimitation of the exclusive economic zones in the Eastern Mediterranean, Turkey not being hesitant in coupling the deployment of hard power means with an inflammatory rhetoric, you're all aware of that, and for Greek decision-makers, most Greek decision-makers already since the mid-2020s, Turkey is being viewed as a revisionist state who embraces the geography of the Ottoman Empire and who exhibits the same pattern of aggressive behavior, not solely against Greek, but also against many other countries in the Eastern Mediterranean. That's the map of the Maviva Tan. You're aware of that, I assume. There has been an attempt taken at the Liamev. It was Pavlov's idea about how we can send a message to the external audience, the European audience, the international audience, by asking, by asking the question, is Turkey a problem partner? Obviously it is. And we explain why is that so, both with regard to its relations with international actors and international institutions, as well as with certain states in its neighborhood. That's an interactive map. Any of you who might be interested, you might get a better idea of that behavior of Turkey. Turkey over the last 3 years. So I come to my, at last, I come to my point. Okay. Smart balancing. As I mentioned, my research question is obviously how a state can make an efficient use of the available limited means, to effectively balance the threatening power. That's the main problem, Turkey, okay, but also deal with additional challenges and risks. As I mentioned, polycrisis is the new norm in the Eastern Mediterranean, so there is a need for Greece to come up with a less costly and more efficient balancing policy vis-à-vis Turkey, because there are many other issues it has to deal with, right? So its balancing policy is in need of refinement. Towards what directions? Let me highlight some of the issues which seem, at least in my view, are there, and suggest that the balancing policy Greece should employ vis-à-vis Turkey is against intense hard balancing, which to a certain extent is the policy being followed by Greece. Some points here. Expansion is more difficult. You have probably heard about that balance between offense and defense and what that suggests. Well, it seems that the balance is in favor of defense, which might not be the case for, you know, for the months or the years to come. There might be changes, but for now, it seems that defense has the advantage, and that makes expansion more difficult. The norm of territorial integrity is present. I assume some of you would argue that has been weakened. Yes, by all means, but it is present. It is still present. The regional environment is not receptive to revisionist policies. International institutions can still be used for soft balancing and engagement. And last but not least, that's a very important point, has to do with what is Turkey? What is really Turkey? We usually refer to Turkey as being a revisionist power. What does that mean? What kind of revisionist power is Turkey? Is there a security dilemma working between Greece and Turkey, or there is no security dilemma, and Turkey is a predatory state, as Hitler or Russia, probably, right, as Hitler or Putin, so we should deal with Turkey accordingly. Well, we have not done much work on that, unfortunately. We should do much more for giving a particular content to what we refer as what we call Turkish revisionism. That particular type of revisionism. That would in turn lead us to better employee strategies for dealing with that particular type of revisionism, right? And come up with better mixtures of balancing policies. For example, we do know that Turkey has moved from an interest-based to a security-based to a power-based foreign policy. Great. What does it tell for what kind of revision state is Turkey? Nothing. Or not, well, less, I would say, than the ones we are in need of for understanding what kind of revision state Turkey is, and employ the appropriate balancing strategies. So I'll try to give you an idea about what I call smart balancing as the appropriate strategy that should be employed by, devised by Greece vis-à-vis Turkey. The need for that is obvious. I have already mentioned that. Let me give you some hints about the rationale of that strategy, the method, and the scope before moving on to particular examples. The rationale of smart balancing. The need of Greece to change Turkey's behavior by impeding the Turkey's ability to profit from aggressive policies by increasing the marginal costs of these policies, by delegitimizing the target state's behavior in the eyes of the broader international community. That should be the rationale of that strategy. The method, the approach, the methodology has to do with, as we call it, indirect, not direct approach, because direct approach has costs, and we are interested in avoiding costs or consequences. So we better focus on how we can adopt an indirect approach that would manage to alter Turkey's cost-benefit calculus. How? Through international institutions and through concerted diplomacy for avoiding the costs. A direct approach would entail. And a direct approach is an approach of hard balancing of traditional hard security strategies such as arms build-ups or former military alliances. The scope, I have already mentioned that there is a need for better defining the end state of any strategy we are interested in playing. That is particularly true for conflict diets. The end state matters, meaning that for this strategy, that smart balancing strategy, I propose we should follow, there are short-term goals and medium and long-term goals. The short-term goal obviously has to do with the crisis stability, crisis management of what is being happening, or it used to happen up to the catastrophic earthquakes in Turkey, because it seems that there's a new climate in relations with it, much better climate in relations with Greece and Turkey. And of course, stabilization relations, meaning balance of power. But this is not the end state. In medium and long term, that balancing strategy should aim at the resolution of the conflict. This is particularly true for any revisionist state we have to deal with. Right? Balance of power means certain things. I mean, it means you can get certain benefits out of it, but those costs of this behavior by a revision state might reappear, and the obvious evolution of things is exactly that. Instead of having a revision state being happy with the balance of power, regardless of the arms races, it might also entail, right, that balance of power. Achieving balance of power, you have to strengthen your armed forces, and then, based on that security dilemma, the other side would do the very same thing, and so on and so forth. So I propose two particular pillars of that smart balancing. What I call smart balancing. One has to do with the limited hard balancing, and the other pillar has to do with soft balancing. And I'll give you examples regarding Greece and Turkey. Not simply repeat myself by saying, from a theoretical point of view, these are the criteria or these are the conditions that should be fulfilled and so on and so forth. So limited hard balancing has to do with limited arms build-ups. Talking about Greece, right? Limited arms build-ups to acquire the minimum deterrent ability. and it's an equilibrium that preserves peace, not military superiority. Greece investing in strategic partnerships with key neighboring countries, Israel and Egypt, and certain pro-Western Arab states. It does that to a certain extent, right? But it seems that it has to be refined somehow with regard to its direction. Those strategic partnerships are anti-Turkish. And we say it openly and loudly. We shouldn't do that, not simply shouldn't tell so, right? Build a coherent and functional crisis management mechanism, meaning that we are in need of not allowing for fait accompli to happen in the Aegean or the Eastern Mediterranean, as well as to prevent a hot incident by accident. And that's the next pillar is the most, I think, the it's more interesting one, but it's hard to come up with, you know, particular initiatives that would manage to provide results at the end of the day at this soft balancing level. So my suggestion is to keep supporting Turkey's European path by linking, I fully understand that the European Union is not the European Union of the past. It is not a strong leverage, you know, Greece might use for better dealing with Turkey. Although weak leverage, European Union is a useful tool for better dealing with Turkey by linking activation of elements of the positive agenda. And there are here some thoughts about the upgrade of the customs union or a new deal on migration with certain conditionality. This is how things work, as you know, with Turkey abandoning the casus belli or accepting the jurisdiction of the International Court of Justice. Also, Greece can be an agenda setter for multilateral initiatives. There are already initiatives taken by the European Union, and they have ceased, somehow forgotten, disappeared. And Greece is not a supporter of those initiatives. Although it could be an agenda setter of those particular multilateral initiatives. As, for example, the multilateral conference on the Eastern Mediterranean, and we might talk about it if you are interested. Reactivation of the exploratory talks, and particular initiatives for the establishment of confidence and security building measures, safety net in the Aegean. I remind you at this point that it is Turkey, particularly after the earthquakes, Attar, for example, the Minister of Defense of Turkey, has rung a bell saying, we have so many times asked for confidence and security building measures groups to meet, and Greece is refusing. It's refusing all the time. Well, what is the best way for delegitimizing those kind of narratives on the part of Turkey by being part of those particular initiatives? I'll conclude with that. The prerequisite for successful balancing. International legitimacy, well, for simply put it, for this smart balancing to employ, for Greece, for this smart balancing to be devised, there should be certain preconditions, certain prerequisites that should be first fulfilled or met. That is international legitimacy. That particular strategy should enjoy international legitimacy. Number two, internal coherence, meaning that the at least two pillars of that strategy, that is defense policy and foreign policy, should somehow be mutually supported rather than undermined. And number three, efficiency. We should do more with less. That was the very first point I made in my presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you, Anita. That was very interesting, very thought-provoking, and very clear. Before bringing colleagues in, perhaps I could just start with two questions. The SMART policy. Of course, SMART is a term which has been used across disciplines in different situations. But I guess this combination of the hard and the soft is something which has been used in other cases of foreign policy by other powers, large and small. When you were talking, I thought this may be the Cold War in the 1980s, kind of the Western approach to Gorbachev, Thatcher coming back and saying this is someone we can do business with, etc. And I suppose there's an argument that eventually it works. You might also extend it to say that the hard and soft approach also worked in Northern Ireland. We're about to celebrate the 25th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement. And you could say that the different iterations of British policy towards the IRA came to balance hard and soft more than early on. So the first point, I think, would be just to clarify that to what extent are you applying a frame, a combination of strategies, which has been used in other international contexts, and how far is it uniquely derived from the Greco-Turkish relationship?
The remark is very useful, actually, to work I have not done so far. So I assume I have to better look at cases you have already mentioned too, but I'm sure there might be many more.
Yes.
Mostly related to great powers policies, which is an issue of methodological importance that should also take care into consideration.
Yes.
Given that Greece is a small slash medium power, so there are certain issues very much involved with the strategies a small or
yes.
a medium power might employ. Yeah. So
well, conceptually, you were also influenced, you were saying before, you derive some of the conceptual frame from.
There has been a work done by a colleague of mine in McGill University, T.D. Paul, who has written a book on restraining great powers by looking at the paths followed, the balancing paths followed by great powers vis-a-vis other great powers. And his main point was that it was a kind of a paradox, contrary to what we had expected for hard balancing. Rule, say, it was soft balancing most of the time that has managed to successfully deal with.
Okay. So that was the larger question. Perhaps the more short-term question. Both Greece and Turkey are facing elections, and I wonder whether in. It's obvious what Athens must be hoping for in Ankara in terms of election results. Should, on the basis of what you've said, should Ankara also be hoping for a coalition in Athens?
What kind of coalition?
Yes, okay. Okay.
What is the relation you have in mind?
One that straddles the centre ground, e.g. New Democracy. I just wonder whether that might combination of hard and soft might be more likely than a single party government of the centre right.
Well, actually, you have to touch upon both poles, let's say, the one in Athens, the one in Ankara. Mm. Right? Yes, I would be more in favour, I would say, of a coalition government. In Athens, and New Pasok for devising this kind of strategy. Of course, after the elections, but this is dependent on what is going on. What will be the results will be in Ankara, and in my view, and based on the political manifesto, for example, of the opposition so far, it seems that it would be much more preferable, at least in my view, for the opposition to Çavuşoğlu.
Yes.
To win the elections, even that, again, based on the political manifesto so far, it seems that they are much more ready for making that, I wouldn't say U-turn, but that change, that turn towards the West, which provides Greece with much more leverage for dealing with Turkey.
Right, thank you. Then let's take some questions first, Vasilis, and then please go.
Thank you very much for the presentation, the analysis. I took issue with a number of things about sort of, you know, what caused the change in 2004, what you said, where we lost the EU leverage and so forth, or more recently and stuff. But I think that the root of my problem with these points is mainly on the framing of Turkey to start with. And in the beginning and throughout actually the presentation, you used the term threatened versus threatening. States. And I mean, I haven't spoken with many foreign policy analysts in Turkey, but they don't see Turkey as a threatening state.
As threatening Greece.
Sometimes they even go to say that Greece threatens Turkey, although, yeah. But this is not my experience from the other side, if you want. And but also, it is not, I think, you know, we sometimes talk about aggression states, or, you know, but it's not necessarily. I'm not a foreign policy expert in any way, but I'm not quite sure this is the language that it would be used in different contexts within foreign policy analysis about threatening states and not threatening. And I thought, okay, maybe this is some within the context of the Greek-Turkish relation. But then at the end, you also said that, you know, we don't know what type of revisionist state Turkey is and whether it is, or under Erdogan at least. Maybe it is the Hitler type of state or the Putin type of state. And I wonder whether this creates a very myopic view of what Turkey is, because Turkey, of course, has been very, I mean, you know, many problems. You mentioned the zero problems with the neighbors policy, but has many problems. But actually, they have also done quite a lot of diplomacy, military diplomacy, but also, you know, non-military diplomacy with Syria, with Ukraine, and they do have a role. I mean, you know, and they leverage very much the migration, as you said, issue, the Syrian refugee crisis with the European Union. So it is definitely not seen by others. I don't know what, you know, how Greece can present internationally Turkey, but other actors do see Turkey as, you know, not a perfect partner, but definitely a partner that can bring stability. And, you know, it is not an aggressor who can be a Putin or a Hitler. So I wonder whether this, the opposite of congruence, you know, between the domestic view of Greece, you know, this distance between how Greece views Turkey versus how other parts of the international community view Turkey, may then hinder, you know, the analysis about, you know, what is the limit? I mean, I agree with the premise, of course, yeah, a combination of hard and soft, but what is the limit of hard and what is the limit of soft if we do not have the same perception of Turkey as, you know, key players in the international community do?
Thank you for the points made. Actually, I do see some congruence of images or ways of looking at Turkey in Greece and other and others over the last years. So it's I doubt this is a kind of a Greek way of looking at Turkey, right? Which has nothing to do with, you know.
You have the Eliamat chart.
Yes. It's, yes. Well, that explains a lot about the cleavages and the problems Turkey has, I mean, itself created with almost the rest of the world. It has nothing to do with Greece. It has to do with relations with NATO and how Turkey behaves within NATO, although it is being considered, as you mentioned, as a necessary partner, I would put it this way. Former US ambassador used to refer to Turkey as a state we can, it's hard to live with, but impossible to live without.
Yes.
I think that describes a lot. Very well, how others view Turkey, which is much closer to the view of the Greek decision makers. That let me put it this way: Greek decision makers or Greek analysts. Okay? So, because that's a summary of how the Greeks, that is, the policy makers and the analysts, look at Turkey, and Turkey is threatening. Threatening Greece. I mean, it's whether I should have put it in more politically correct terms, I don't know how I should have put it, but I think that's the case. Turkey threatens Greece. Over the last 5 years, it threatens others as well. So there are counter coalitions against Turkey. That's not it. You know, this is not out of the blue. It happened. So that tells a lot about how others, not the Greeks, analysts or policymakers, view Turkey.
Okay. Vasilis may buy you a drink after. Dr. Brugger.
Thank you very much for the presentation. I just want to follow up on two points Professor Featherstone raised. So first one is that it strikes me that in the last slide, these policies that you suggested, that Greece would benefit from all those, regardless of balancing against Turkey.
You mean this one?
No, the very last one, like legitimacy,
yes,
being an agenda setting in multilateral institutions.
Yes.
So to what extent do you think we should see those in the context of balancing against Turkey, as opposed to perhaps Greece's global strategy? That's my first question. And my second question is, I find the point on predatory state interesting, although I'm not sure if I agree with the analogy with him, sir, but I was just wondering, to what extent do you talk about Turkey as a unified actor? So so there are lots of references to realism, neorealist framework here, but at the same time, how do you see the role of domestic politics in Turkey? For example, Mavi Vatan, was popularized when nationalists were in coalition with the AKP. So to what extent do you see, when you're trying to categorize Turkey, to what extent is it the AKP government? And you know, that can be seen also in the context of the upcoming elections. So how do you see potential change as a result of domestic politics in Turkey?
In the reverse order. What I'm interested in is the to what extent those narratives have been incorporated in the official language. or not? That's a very important question. So the answer to this question is if they did incorporate it into the official language of the World War. And that creates a certain amount of fear to others. Forget Greeks. Forget the Greeks. Forget Greece. To others in the Eastern Mediterranean. That was the reason there has been counterbalancing efforts by other states, not Greece, other states, to balance that hegemonic role of Turkey. The reason was exactly that. There has been an incorporation of that narratives, of those narratives, to the official language. That's a problem. And you cannot really distinguish about what is meant and what is not. So you've got to, as we call it, as we say, better safe than sorry, right? So when a state has to come up with a strategy for balancing a threat, it has to take some narratives given, let's say, to the extent that, of course, they are incorporated as they have. Now, your first question was about...
So benefiting from all those policies, regardless of, you know, can we see them in the context of balancing against Turkey?
How can Greece benefit?
Yeah.
Are they unique to Greco-Turkish relations, or should they be generalized for Greek foreign policy in other respects as well?
That's probably an issue I have to find out after completing the whole thing. Hoping that there will be some generalizations of what we're going to write about for this particular case. That's a very, very good point.
Okay, let's try to. There's a lot of interest in your talk, so perhaps we can start grouping the sphere.
I have a number of questions and points. I'll try and be as brief as possible. Firstly, I find this very interesting. We reached the same conclusion through a different route. Let me put it that way, and maybe I can explain myself here. Firstly, polycrisis, where you started off with the idea of polycrisis. They're only relevant, in a sense, to Greek-Turkish relations because the crisis that you mentioned at the beginning, for example, migration, energy, for example, are not, in my view, necessarily polycrises. They are crises which are weaponized. They are issues which are weaponized and become part of the central crisis. So there's a central balance between Greece and Turkey, which we know is a conflict over certain issues in the Aegean, and that over time is affected by certain other issues which arise and are weaponized, instrumentalized by one side or another. So I'm not sure whether they're polycrises or whether there's certain other issues which come into play. The biggest problem for Greece, historically speaking, is that Turkey has been strategically more important and geopolitically more important. And that's the thing Greece always has to contend with. Now, the one success story that you highlighted in your presentation is that in 1999, Turkey became Europe's problem and not just Greece's problem. And what you suggest later on of as re-bilateralization is in effect de-Europeanization. I know you sort of said, oh, de-Europeanization doesn't really matter, but it became de-Europeanized. And what I would argue is that the smart balancing that you're talking about now is in effect a way by which Greece has attempted to reintroduce Europe into the equation, as well as the United States of America. Mm. And this is where the smart balancing comes in. Because there's a realization, I think, which is missing from your narrative, and I'm sure it fits in quite neatly, that the nature of European diplomacy has also changed. That Europe is no longer a normative power. Normative power in Europe is a failed model. It's gone, right? It's gone in terms of Central and Eastern Europe, even. It's gone in terms of Turkey. It failed in Ukraine. So let's not talk about normative power Europe. So what kind of power is Europe? And it's interesting to see that in the last decade or so, Europe, at least rhetorically, is moving to the idea of geopolitics mattering, of hard power becoming more important, and of balancing values and interests. And I think this is where the soft balancing that you're talking about, the smart balancing that you're talking about, is in the final analysis a way of suggesting that in the past Greece always put values first, the law of the sea, peaceful resolution of conflicts, the ICJ, which could be the end product, but to reach that end we have to also emphasize that there are interests at stake. And in the last few years I think Greece has managed to do that in a way that fits in with either European foreign policy or the certain European actors and how they see European foreign policy developing. So a bilateral relationship with France, with a hard military guarantee at the end of it, is part of this move to interests and values being a way of contending with rival powers, revisionist powers, powers that don't believe in the liberal international system, and so on and so forth. So, you know, I'm just trying to say there may be something beyond Greece in terms of smart balancing that may fit into your narrative.
Okay. If we can hold that, please.
Thank you for a fascinating presentation. As you pointed out, there's been significant changes in foreign policy over the last 40 years due to changes of government. On the other hand, Kevin pointed out when the, for example, the Irish Good Friday Agreement or discussions with Gorbachev in the 80s were achieved when there wasn't any internal disagreement from the people who were discussing. Thatcher was supported by Labour at the time, or rather major by Labour, etc., etc. Looking at internal coherence and changing the framework, and taking into account what happened with North Macedonia issue and the party politic games that were played at the time, do you think that Greece would be able to deal with a soft balancing and eventual compromise where there will have to be some give and take, or due to the history, various parties will take advantage and not allow that to go forward?
If you should allow both of those points, would you like to respond now?
Well, let me start from again. I think I had to refer to go back to the safe places of culture for answering your question about whether Greece would be willing to accept a compromise. Although Turkey is quite a different thing from North Macedonia, right? In terms of how we, in terms of asymmetry of power, first of all, right? We usually say that it doesn't matter, but it does, and we know it does, right? So going back to your question about the coalition, kind of a Mitsotakis and Vlachis coalition, for example. Yes, that would be, could be an issue for Greece. I mean, it could be a choice of that kind for a government, for a coalition government that is allowed to take decisions on foreign policy based on a common platform, let's say. Mitsotakis and Andriulakis' platform, to a certain extent, are in favor of this kind of compromise solutions, yes. And I think would be much, things would be much easier for Mitsotakis to that coalition government compared to the situation now, which is, seems to be sandwiched somehow between its extremes, right? Well, thank you for the points, Spiros. They're very good points. Actually, I think Europe is there. I mean, I had somehow attempted to. We have Europe be back and strengthen that strategy of Greece of a member state vis-a-vis a non-member state. You're right about changes within the European Union in terms of strategic culture, by all means. Kind of a distance from, you know, the safe position of normative power to something that would should attempt to manage a much more complicated new world, much more risky new world. We do know that from the various documents released by the European Union in terms of defense and security. on the issues of polycrisis, my reference was about, or part of the dimension of that polycrisis notion has to do with the fact that they happen concurrently. That's why we call them polycrisis. They're all crises, all crises based on particular issues or emanating from certain issues are somehow connected, no matter what. All of them are somehow connected in the Eastern Mediterranean. So the challenge, if you like, for Greece is how it can deal with various crises happening at the very same time. And this is an issue. That was an issue for Greece in 2020. That was an issue for Greece in 2021, right? And to the extent that Turkey has followed a much more aggressive policy, things could have been quite difficult for Greece to manage, to deal with. And Turkey did not that, hasn't done that. And that, I think, tells a lot about what kind of revisionist state Turkey is, whether it has to take advantage or not from a neighbor which is whose experiences or is in a very difficult position. That was the case, for example, when Turkey was a strong power in the periphery. It was it has hegemonic ambitions, and Greece was has experienced the economic crisis, the various memoranda, and Turkey, in case it was a predatory state, it should have taken advantage of it. I think still we have to elaborate on that, better look on what kind of revisionism is there. Okay. We are still lacking that knowledge, I would say, of Turkey, and we are instead tilting much easier to conclusions that very general ones and doesn't say much, really. Turkey is a revisionist state, doesn't say much, right?
Okay, I think there is still a few hands. Can we just take the last round of questions and perhaps just a brief response, please?
Just a really quick question. So firstly, thank you very much for the presentation. It's just regarding the second point on this slide. And you suggest that Greece should invest in strategic partnerships. Yeah. And one of the countries you mentioned is Israel. And I just have just a thought, I suppose. And so in terms of Israel's occupation of certain Palestinian lands, do you think it's advisable that Greece should start investing in a strategic partnership with that country, considering the plight of the Greek Cypriots and their, you know, claims to that land which have been occupied by Turkey? Do you think that doesn't, I suppose, undermine their plight?
It's still the same point, but another more general question in terms of how credible do you think it is in investing in these partnerships, given that in the recent developments, actually Turkey has been mending ties with Egypt? Turkey has been mending ties with the Egyptian government, so the Sisi government, with the UAE, with the swap deals, etc., and with Israel, we've seen some statements, etc. Or do you think it's something that is still doable by Greece?
Okay, I think that's it. If you could answer just briefly, please.
Well, yes. The issue of values. Values-based foreign policy is easier said than done. Greece, as all our states, had to deal with probably not that kind of a Netanyahu style Israel. That's the case right now. To the extent, I think the point here is has to do with the anti-Turkish orientation of those alliances. I think one of the mistakes made by Greece was to openly and loudly say this is an anti-Turkish coalition. That limits its options to a great degree.
The answer to both questions.
Yes. Yeah, well, okay. I assume to a certain extent.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. That's great.
You told me to be brief.
And you've done exactly what I was asked. Before we finish, can I mention our next seminar, which is in this room and will be on Wednesday. It is not in this room. In the sense of the room on the second, 202, but in this building.
Yes.
And that will be on Wednesday, the 22nd of March. And we actually have a panel of speakers under the title Exploring Culture Wars in Greece, Mapping New Conflicts and Voter Support. And we have three speakers. Sokratis Koniotos, Emeritus Professor of Sociology at the University of the Peloponnese, Rula Nesi, Senior Lecturer in Political Science at the University of Surrey, and Dimitris Sotiropoulos, your colleague at the University of Athens. So Culture Wars, 22nd of March at 6 o'clock. Thank you very much indeed for a very interesting talk, and obviously it prompted much discussion. So thank you very much indeed.